Today, the Great Reset has already started. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined by Lisa Barwick from the Citizens Party. Hi there.
Hi, Martin.
Great to have you on the show. And we've got a really, really important topic to discuss today because I tell you, I reckon there are more YouTube shows up there at the moment about the Great Reset and every pundit's got his view or her view about what's going on. And what I want to try and do is strip away some of the sort of hype and try and understand what's really going on.
We're going to demystify it a little bit for people today. And what we're going to present is a sequence of events that indicate that the Great Reset has started and is in fact well underway, but it's not necessarily what you think. There's an effort to change the very nature of banking, and in particular to prevent the kinds of banking facilities that would allow us to rebuild and nations to rebuild our economies. So we're going to go through that step by step.
Yeah, and I think it's also worth saying that this really questions fundamentals like democracy and who makes decisions and who's accountable and how do those large international organisations intersect with local decision making and local politics and who holds who accountable.
Yes, exactly. And we have to get people involved in politics to change these legislations, these decisions, and that can be done.
Well, we showed with the cash ban it can be done if we get enough reaction and response. But the first thing to do is to try and understand a little bit about the trajectory. So why don't we start with the global financial crisis and, in fact, a bit before that, because what we saw was the development of, I guess, ever more powerful central banks. So, you know, people who are not elected, people who represent, we're not quite sure. So the Federal Reserve, of course, is owned by banks. Other central banks are, to lesser or greater extent, owned by the governments who sort of put them up there. But the central banks, under the Bank for International Settlements, get together and talk a lot about how to control the financial system.
Exactly. And, I mean, just to start with the global financial crisis, 2008 is probably a useful start point because a series of shifts began really at that point because under crisis circumstances, the US Federal Reserve entered into what former Wall Street banker and author Naomi Prinz described as an unprecedented collusion where they coordinated a quantitative easing program that was unheard of in history. She described it, Naomi Prinz, as the most massive transfer of power to unelected bankers, where they were able to funnel money into the biggest of banks through the bailout programs. And then later, the bail-in program, which you've talked about many times on your show, Martin, was introduced, which was supposed to reduce that too big to fail concentration of banks, but which in reality and in practice, in many examples that have occurred throughout Europe, has ended up concentrating banks more because a lot of those bail-ins have had to be accompanied by bailouts. And in most of the cases that I've researched, those banks that were bailed out and bailed in ended up being swallowed up by larger banks in any case. So, and that even siphoned more money into the system because of governments paying out on deposit guarantee schemes that went into those bigger financial structures and many people not seeing their money back from those deposit guarantee schemes for up to 5 years. Mm. So there's been a variety of ways. And the other thing about the bail-in that I'd mention is it gave the Bank for International Settlements unprecedented oversight of national regulatory capabilities. And we saw that here where APRA was told what to do with its bail-in legislation, which was passed in February 2018. And even though that was passed a year later, the International Monetary Fund came in and said, well, we're not satisfied with how you've done it. We want the bail-in of deposits to be explicitly called for and applicable. And they also specified that we should end the Treasurer's ability to direct APRA and end Parliament's oversight and their ability to disallow APRA actions. So, yeah, you're talking about this completely unaccountable faction of banks, from the BIS to central banks and other parties, that are dictating policy, and that, you know, since 2008 really became extreme.
Right. And the key note here is financial stability is what they're talking about. In other words, what they're doing is protecting the financial system. So all that liquidity that was created was pumped into the financial system to support stock markets and, you know, banks, share prices and all of those things, the bond markets. This is nothing to do with the real economy.
Exactly. Something which is becoming very obvious is that with the concentration of banks into the too big to fail banks, smaller banks, commercial banks, community banks, public banks, postal banks, they're all disappearing. And as you've mentioned, things like negative interest rates, which I think is getting into our next point, have really affected the capability of small banks to exist.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So what's one of the things, if you look at Europe, for example, where they've taken rates into negative territory, massive quantitative easing, what that is doing is putting pressure on the financial margins of particularly smaller banks compared with larger ones. And we're seeing all around the world now smaller banks disappearing, getting gobbled up, even some fintechs being gobbled up too. So this is a concentration of power in a smaller number of larger, often international financial organizations that really are operating above national borders and above local supervision, because they're part of this global superstructure that's been built, connected to the Bank for International Settlements, supported by central banks. And the central banks, as they issue more and more liquidity through quantitative easing, continue to drive rates lower. They are manipulating the yield curve by essentially buying at particular points along the yield curve to set the price. And that is driving the price of money down. And that process, which has rolled on for at least a decade now and continues to roll in a more accelerated way now, no one has been able to figure out how to get out of that. So this is a one-way process where rates go lower and lower and lower into negative territory, and where effectively, on the back of trying to support the financial system, the real economy gets taken to the cleaners.
Exactly. And further to that, there's now a debate about whether we need commercial banks in existence at all. So when you're talking about lending into the real economy, that would just become a joke if commercial banks don't exist. But one of the things that we saw at the beginning of last year, coming into March, with the COVID crisis striking the United States, is that they initiated relief programs where the Treasury created a certain amount of credit, made it available to the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve started these lending programs to go into various purchases and so forth. I mean, and they even did things like purchasing corporate bonds and so forth. So the Fed took on a bond portfolio, which, you know, has dubious legality to it. But there were certain funds that were supposed to go to so-called Main Street lending, and it didn't happen. And so you have this direction of credit, again, completely getting funneled in to financial speculation rather than the real economy. Now, the other factor about, of course, commercial banking is if a central bank digital currency comes into effect, Philadelphia Federal Reserve has speculated that commercial banks would be obsolete because part of the plan that the Federal Reserve has outlined is that any stimulus program, like they did through the COVID crisis, each individual person would have a Fed bank account, personal Fed bank account. So this is kind of like personal QE, if you like, or helicopter money. And where that money goes straight into your account, And of course, in any kind of crisis, as they spell out in their document, deposits, people would be feel much safer to have their deposits in the central bank than in a commercial bank. So having attracted deposits away from commercial banks would essentially go out of existence. And there's been some people, like one article I was reading, I think it was in the Financial Times or The Economist, which was saying, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing to have no commercial banks anymore. So this concentration of power that we're discussing is just, there's no end to it. It's phenomenal.
Well, and of course, the question there is if central banks are pulling those levers without essentially much political oversight, and I would argue that politicians are deliberately turning their back and looking the other way and whistling a tune and saying, well, it's nothing to do with me, it's the central bank's fault, right? What that basically means is that there are people making these sorts of decisions and laying out these plans without any tick from anybody who's been elected, let alone ordinary voters, you know, who are not aware of what this is all looking like, right? So we are seeing this happening in a way which is, one, quite sneaky, and two, deliberately obfuscated. I believe that a lot of the stuff that's going on is deliberately being played through in a way that is not transparent. And I don't think the truth is out there, you know, frankly. I think it's deliberately being obfuscated simply because if people really woke up to what this means, then mm-hmm. there would be an outcry.
Yeah, and a lot of elements are there to be found if you go looking, elements of the truth, but it's a matter of people looking in the first place and secondly, being able to put those elements together to actually see top down what's being constructed here. And I know for my own part, just following financial and economic goings on over the last 2 to 3 years, it's only been step by step when you see one event then another and you begin to put the picture together and you think, wow, this is not looking good. So now the other thing I wanted to talk about from what you just raised is a real shift point, which struck myself and obviously a lot of people, was the Jackson Hole Summit of Central Bankers that took place in August 2019. Because, well, number one, that was where Mark Carney gave his speech calling for a central bank digital currency to replace the US dollar. And he talked about a new financial architecture. So this is part of that whole architecture of what the Great Reset really represents in financial terms. But the other thing was that prior to that meeting, BlackRock, which is the world's largest asset management fund and has several former central bankers on its board, drafted a paper in which they talked about something which has been dubbed monetary regime change. And this is where you said the unaccountability really comes in and where politicians are absolving themselves of responsibility because we're conducting this transfer of power where, in effect, we would be giving central banks, which are independent, which function completely independently of elected governments and other financial powers, because some of the, for instance, Fed programs that I mentioned through the COVID bailout were conducted by BlackRock. BlackRock was given the job without tender to actually run some of these bond funds and so forth that would buy up corporate bonds and whatnot. So you've got this combination of central banks and hedge funds, asset management, big banks that are working together. And what the monetary regime change was about was to give these powers, these private powers, a greater oversight and decision making on fiscal policy, so on where the government is spending its money. And so you would have this element of private control over far more than just monetary policy, but taking it that next step. And how they described it was Philip Hildebrand, the vice chair of BlackRock, said, "We're going to see a regime change in monetary policy that's as big a deal as the one we saw between pre-crisis and post-crisis," which was the introduction of quantitative easing we talked about. And one element of this, he said, an important one, will be a blurring of fiscal and monetary activities and responsibilities. So that's another big aspect of this, where those private powers are going for as much as they can to take, to carve out what should be decisions made by elected officials.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that, because of course there's also another revolving door. If you think of Janet Yellen, who used to run the Fed, she's now effectively in the Treasury Department in the US. We've got the head of the ECB, who used to be at the IMF, and Mario Draghi, who used to be the ECB, is now in Italian politics, right?
I know.
So you can start to see how the structure of the political and financial dimensions are actually being fused together like this.
Exactly. And if I can, I might just quote a couple of other people on this monetary regime change, because it, I think it really stresses the point of what's afoot here. After Jackson Hole, the president of the St. Louis Fed, James Bullard, said to the Financial Times that a financial regime shift is in process, which he said means that cherished notions of central banking are being rethought. And there were a few other things after that, but after the March 2020 COVID interventions, there was a host of people reflecting on this because they started to put two and two together. So on the 15th of April 2020 in the Washington Post and Bloomberg, there was an article, Mnuchin's partnership with Powell blurs lines between Fed and the Treasury, saying that central bank has been granted a bigger role in US fiscal policy. You had Scott Minard, the chairman of Guggenheim Investments and member of Federal Reserve Bank of New York's Investment Advisory Committee, on the 11th of June 2020, saying they have essentially told the world that there is now a backstop on corporate debt. We have now socialized credit risk and we have forever changed the nature of how our economy functions. Matt Taibbi, he had an article on the 13th of May 2020 about this too, but I wanted to cite what he said in September 2018, talking about the 2008 bailout fiasco. He described it as a bank-state merger which converted Wall Street into a vehicle for annually privatizing a big chunk of America's GDP into the hands of a few executives. Then you had on the 30th of April 2020, economic columnist for the Washington Post, Steve Perlstein, who said the Fed has assumed the role as a financial backstop and lender of last resort to every major corporation. It's no longer just banks that are too big to fail. It's now the entire corporate sector. So this is with these corporate bond buy-ups. And then finally, Jim Bianco of Bianco Research told Bloomberg on the 27th of March 2020, this scheme essentially merges the Fed and Treasury into one organisation. Now, I mean, this is something that we've written about in our publications of the Citizens Party that essentially is the definition of fascism. When in 1938, when Franklin Delano Roosevelt was trying to deconstruct the cartelization and the control that had existed through the war years, he said the first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to a point where it becomes stronger than the democratic state itself. That in its essence is fascism, ownership of government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power. So, and Mussolini himself, who was the first to bring corporate entities into the process of government, said that fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it is a merger of state and corporate power. So what we're seeing with this Fed-Treasury cooperation on fiscal policy and on, control of bailouts and regulation top-down is essentially that kind of concentration of power and merger of power where the private sector can dictate.
Absolutely. It is pretty scary when you actually lay it out like that, isn't it? And there's a couple of consequences. The first is that effectively, free markets and capitalism has gone out the window because now everything is being supported. Nothing can fail. Right. So what that basically means is that, the idea that capital flows to the more productive solutions has gone. Basically, everything is being supported just by being supported by central banks. The second point, which is worth thinking about, is that banks are less and less able to make money from the normal things they actually make money from, like lending and deposits. So they're getting more and more involved in speculation, which is one of the reasons why the derivative sector is going through the roof. And if you look at the multiple, to the underlying that derivatives now represent, it's a really scary issue in terms of when that and if that goes wrong. And the third point is that none of this stuff that we're talking about here is hitting the real economy. So it's no real surprise that the real economy is not performing, that unemployment is higher, wages growth is non-existent, and there's a huge inequality being created. So there's a small proportion of people who are benefiting from this, those who are benefiting from the growth in the financial markets. But the rest of society, both here and other countries, is just being squeezed and squeezed and squeezed. So you can see the social consequences of these policies being playing out.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the big factors in that, which comes into this concentration of the banks that we've been talking about, is the repeal of Glass-Steagall legislation in 1999, which prevented deposit-taking banks from engaging in speculation. As you said, banks have been more and more driven, with the negative rates, with everything, with the whole situation globally, into speculation. Of course, prior to 1999, when Glass-Steagall was repealed, they couldn't do that. But from 1999, every bank had the opportunity to gamble. So it's just too tempting for them to do that. And over 5,000 or around about 5,000 banks disappeared after 1999, just as that process of that fallout took place. So we have to begin to re-implement the types of actual regulation which will ensure that credit can be directed back into the real economy. And also why you see such a freak out here in Australia over the Christine Holgate Watches affair. It's not the what you see on the surface is not the real issue. These big financial players are horrified about the prospect of public banks or postal banks being created, because it's a means of people to put their deposits somewhere which is safe, it's kept hived away from any bail-inable capacity, government protected and so forth. But it's also a capacity, as we've seen in the case in Japan with the Japan Post Bank, where those deposits can then be invested through Treasury and government functions into investment or infrastructure banks that can actually be put towards the real economy.
Yes, and that is really the point. We know that there is a valid role for banks to help society grow and develop. You know, we saw it after the Second World War, and so there is a path to create real value for real people, right? But you've also got that flying in the face of what we're actually seeing, which is preservation of financial stability, the inflationary forces that are basically making the central banks expand and expand and expand their control. And I just want to come back to the other thing that you touched on, this digital currency. It becomes a critical cornerstone of their success. In other words, if you allow people to hold money outside the financial system and in cash, then they can't take the rates to where they want them. They can't actually control and dictate. But as soon as digital currencies become the only way to transact, then effectively that's the last piece of the puzzle, which is why I, for one, I'm very concerned about all of the trajectory talking about central bank digital currencies and how they might play out, because you've got to see it in this broader context. You know, this isn't just a convenience thing. This isn't just, it's easier than notes. You know, it's about control. It's about monitoring. And I'd highlight that in some countries around the world, you know, things like social scores and where you can spend your money is already in train. So this is also another means of control. So one reason why we should be very cautious of the whole concept of digital currencies becoming the norm.
Yeah, and interestingly, after that Jackson Hole summit where Mark Carney raised that, which was August 2019, by the end of that year, Carney made a statement in an IMF paper that he wrote, just straight out saying, look, a new financial system is under construction. And I wanted to add another element of that, which raises perhaps more questions than answers. But if you think back to the September 2019 repo crisis, you know, that all froze up, and yet at the same time there were big bankers that were saying they had money. It wasn't that they didn't have money, but they stopped lending to hedge funds and so forth. The whole thing was thrown into such disarray that it became the impetus for other changes which aren't set in stone yet, but some of the proposals included JP Morgan in October 2019 in a client note proposing a permanent lending facility where the big banks would no longer have to provide that liquidity in the overnight lending and repo markets, but where the Fed would do all of that. And that's also another thing that's dubious legally for the Fed to do. And then in January 2020, there was a proposal that was discussed in the Wall Street Journal on the 14th of January, where the Fed was discussing the ability for that they could directly lend to hedge funds. So usually hedge funds have to get that overnight liquidity when they've got margin calls and so forth from that repo machinery, that plumbing architecture, but the Fed would, you know, bypass that. So, and then it's something that also comes up with the whole GameStop thing, because, you know, there's the theory that it was the people versus the hedge funds, but then there's also the theory, because of the amounts of money and volume of trading involved, that maybe it was a falling out amongst thieves of big investment banks versus hedge funds. And we know hedge funds at the end of 2019, as this repo crisis was going on, were seeing an unprecedented number of withdrawals. A number of them were shutting down. The Bank for International Settlements had come out and said hedge funds, you know, could really be the linchpin of a new oncoming crash. So there's a whole series of question marks around what's going on there. And of course, in March 2020, during the COVID crisis, there was a much bigger repo bailout, many, many more volume of injections, and I think a magnitude larger actually than what had occurred in September 2019. And they started doing morning offerings, afternoon offerings. They started adding all kind of different term lengths, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, you know. So there was a huge amount that went on. So we've got, I mean, I think the very biggest question here is, our financial system as it stands today globally is completely bankrupt, completely white-handed out, and we really have to create a new, you know, fair and just financial architecture, not the Great Reset version, but something based around putting it back in the hands of the people and allowing governments to use a financial infrastructure to get the job done of rebuilding economies that are on the brink of collapse.
Absolutely. And that's really the critical point. We are at an inflection point here, right, where effectively I think if we allow central banks to continue to play the cards that they've got, we'll end up with the sort of nightmare future we've been articulating. But there is an opportunity here if we sort of grab back control and say, no, hang on. There's another agenda which is actually way more important, which is, you know, the reconstruction of the real economy and building real jobs and essentially getting stuff back inside democratic control, all of those things, right? But that, of course, requires both political and economic will, right? And my concern is that many people within, shall I call them the mainstream of thinking at the moment, seem to be just dancing along with the central banks and saying, oh, there's nothing to see here, right? Whereas we know that this is a critical point at which decisions need to be taken and need to be taken differently to be able to secure our future.
Yeah, and I'd add to that that leaving things like the Great Reset in the realm of something mystical, there's this all-powerful group somewhere behind the scenes that's pulling all the strings and we can't do anything about it. Well, that's just simply not true. You know, these are all institutions, whether it be Mark Carney through his roles in the Bank of England, the Bank for International Settlements, whether it be the World Economic Forum, these are all individuals. They have their point of view and they have their distinct idea of what they want to do, and they do have a lot of money and they influence governments. But equally, the population, which are larger in number than they are, have a voice as well, and making that voice heard, as you pointed out at the beginning of the discussion with the cash ban, for instance, we saw that if you can put the pressure on politicians, they can be swayed. Yeah, they can be swayed by the big boys too, but they can equally be swayed by the people if the people begin to get engaged.
Absolutely. And I think that's the key message really from this conversation, which is that, you know, the Great Reset hasn't yet finalized, right? There's a lot of work in progress here, but we've also got a chance to steer it and to take it somewhere much more more advantageous for ordinary Australians and, you know, ordinary people around the world, but only if we actively engage with the issues and actively engage with the trajectory ahead. And I guess that we may well be having some further chats in the future about things particularly that people can do to be able to help steer the conversation. But the purpose of this show today was to try and outline what's really going on, right? And to paint on one hand a bit of a nightmarish outcome, but also make the point that it's not set in concrete, it's not certain, and there is still an opportunity to steer it into a different direction if we are smart enough to grab the opportunity.
Yep, for sure.
Really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much. And I'm sure we'll chat again down the track.
Thanks, Martin.
Thanks. Bye-bye.